Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Hi, friends from all over the country and the world. It's another day in the studio with you all and hoping to bring you some good information today. I get a lot of calls about end of life and decision making and all that encompasses what's going on when a person is in the end stages or perceivably the end stages. When sometimes what people think is the end is really 3 or 4 years from the finish line. These can be difficult things to talk about. These can be difficult areas to navigate. And, you know, do we have any pearls of wisdom that can come out of this from people who have gone before us? How do we navigate the stages towards the end? If you have or have not made decisions about, you know, end-of-life procedures and things of that nature, you know, one of the things that really comes up is when someone is the matriarch or the patriarch of the family, and that role has to be transitioned down to one of the children and or friend, or whoever it is, and adult children are always trying to seek direction. They always are, from the person who's the elder. They want to know what that person wants and stay within the boundaries of what that person deems important to them for their life, what they are willing to share and release or keep close to the vest, being money, being their home, things like that. And so, you know, what we have is an opportunity to have a really sound and creative and pragmatic approach, I guess, is how I'm thinking about this, to sitting down with someone and talking about where they want to go if they have their memory and their cognition impaired. Do they want to stay in their home? What that will look like? How we can have something that is palpable, something that makes them feel appreciated and recognized as having insight and you know, all of this sort of comes zinging out of the confusion and the apprehension and everything that goes with trying to figure out how to navigate the end of the life of a person that has cognitive decline or memory loss. And very rarely does that all of the sparks that fly when there's a problem like this. Are people looking at their decision-making roles together, or are they looking at them singularly? Are the family members on the same page? Are you all sitting down and discussing how this is going to play out? If you don't, you're going to have a landslide of decisions to make and emotions to deal with and a lot of angst throughout this process. So pulling from the wisdom of the people who have the diagnosis at the earliest possible junction is really going to help you enormously. Talk to them about what their needs are. Talk to them about what they really want, because when they become too impaired to make that decision, and that's sometime in the late early stage to the early mid stage, a lawyer is not going to sit down with them and allow decisions to be made. By then, it's too late. By then, it is absolutely too late. And this whole thing of not wanting to give up independence, to not want to share information, passwords, accounts, stocks, just what they pay in their monthly rent, what money they have to live on, what is their Social Security, all of that will not behoove you to keep it a secret and not share with the people that are trying to care for you. And people, I'm telling you, when this decision needs to be made is not in the late stage, it's in the early stage, it's in the diagnosis, it's in the area of when all this is coming to light and you're trying to figure out how to deal with the diagnosis and the prognosis, and it's a lot. But that's when you have to sit down and say, okay, I need to start making a list of all my passwords. I need to start making a list of all my bank accounts or my stocks and bonds or my assets and what you would need to sell in the end. We gather a lot of toys through our life, be it cars or boats or vacation homes or whatever the heck it is. We gather a lot of toys and we have to be able to make decisions on who gets those toys in the end. Should they be liquefied to help you with care at some point in time? So it's a really good idea to sit down and make a list of what you have and what you think you might need to liquefy at some point in time, and even make a game plan on the things that you want to keep for more long term during this process, that you still want to go on vacations to your vacation home. You still want to go out on a boat and things like that. But you need to start maybe giving up and telling people about the other things that you own or just somebody that you trust. And it doesn't always have to be a family member. It's not always a family member that we trust the most, right? So think about those kinds of things. Start making lists. And as far as your kids go, or kids as you're looking at your parent that has this issue, this is a time to divide up your roles evenly in the family. You know, one who's going to maintain the property, another that's going to address the bill paying, another that's going to do be the liaison to physicians and handling medications, another one that is going to be the person that takes them to the doctor visits and dentists and things like that. Another could be the person who provides meals and housekeeping. And if your elder person refuses all of this support and interviews, you know, really views it as an interference or you trying to overrule them, that can be pretty scary. So it's, I think what's scarier is when everything's put on one person. And those of you who live out of state from your family member, this is where I'm going to call you out and say, hey, you don't get to be a non-participant because you're not close. That doesn't work. You can be the resource information person for your family. You could go to classes and be educated on the disease and feed back to your families the information that you're receiving and strategies and techniques that they could utilize along the way. You could be a person that maybe reaches out to, like a Craigslist or an Angie's List or something like that to help sell off articles that need to be sold for care. You can do a lot of things. You can be a support. You can be an ear to listen when the people that are closer in town need some help. You can send money. If the person that has a disease needs clothes because of weight changes or needs help with bills or needs help with food and things like that. So just because the disease itself is really insidious and it changes things slowly over a number of years, that person is going to try and conceal their challenges. And the children may realize that they have lapses in their memory. They have lapses in their judgment and things like that. But you have to try to figure out a way to be compelled to want to act and do it before the shift becomes too dramatic, before it becomes traumatic, because that's what happens most of the time. I am reminded of this constantly by the fact that November and December are typically, well, and January, are typically my busiest months. Okay, this is when I get a zillion calls from families, care partners, caregivers, just concerned friends and you know, people that are close to that loved one. And they come home for the holidays and they see the issues. They see the expired food in the refrigerator. They see bills that are not paid. They see confusion and cognitive impairment in the person that has the diagnosis, oftentimes better than somebody that is in town sees it. Because when you're with that person day in and day out all the time, the changes seem slower. They seem more gradual. But from a person that lives afar, they're going to see changes more dramatic because their time period spent with that person is less and less. So when you sit down and you start talking about this with your siblings or family members, friends, whoever it is that is helping to care for this elder person in your family that has a diagnosis, be easy about the way that you talk to each other. Be thoughtful about the way that you engage one another, because nobody likes to feel like they're being judged for the care that they're giving, or why didn't they see something that you can see because you only see the person once a year or twice a year or talk to them on the phone. And you can see a difference dramatically because you don't encounter them all the time. So if you're only talking to them every 2 months or every 3 months or once a week or something, and they're using coping mechanisms and skills to sort of hide their disease, the people closest to them may not see the things that you see because they're answering questions with the same old phrases that they used to, or, oh, I don't need to know the answer to that. I'm retired. Why do I need to know what month it is? Blah, 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 blah. And that could be an easy throw off to the care partner or the family member that's local. So not seeing what's going on isn't necessarily a deficit, or it's not a mistake that a family member has made or that they haven't recognized something they should have. It's much, much more difficult to really see the whole scope of the disease when the person is in their home surroundings and when they feel like they've got a certain amount of control over what's going on in their world. And they have just used incredibly good and skilled coping mechanisms to try to hide the depth of the disease from anybody that comes in their space. So when you come to town this fall and you're seeing your loved ones, and I know we've got the whole COVID going and everything, and people are doing more Zoom calls, and people might not be getting together for holidays like they used to. But I'm telling you, even Zoom calls where you can actually physically see the person can show you, again, the depth of the disease and maybe some significant changes that a local person may not recognize. So when you're sitting down and you're trying to figure out what role each person plays, I think that the person from afar, one thing that you could do, the role that you could assume, would be letting family members know what you see without having it sound like an interrogation or that you're judging them for what they cannot see, okay? Everybody has to have their own space. And families, there are many families that are lovey, huggy, touchy, wonderful. But I don't care how you slice it, you're going to have family members that have issues talking to one another. That these children, these siblings have their own problems with their own aging, and they have rigidities that they've had throughout their life that have never changed, that make it challenging to adjust to the situation of the person, the elder, the parent, whoever you're talking about here, and their situation. And not all parent-children relationships are resolved when the parents reach their senior years. Those things, you just have learned behavior. You grow up with those emotional instabilities. I'm the black sheep of the family. Mom didn't love me as much, or blah, 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 you know. All that stuff has to be put aside when this person gets sick. Well, how do we do that? If we are emotionally unstable people anyway, how do we suddenly get stable and start working together? Well, I mean, that's a problem of the nation right now. Are you kidding me? So we have to learn to listen. We have to learn to be quiet. When you're quiet, you can listen more. And listen to what everybody brings to the table. Listen to what they're seeing about the person with the diagnosis and what they perceive to be the issues with that person. And try not to fight over it. Oh, mom's just, she needs a hearing aid, or dad's always been cantankerous like that or forgetful. This isn't anything new. Sit and listen. You learn more when you listen. And I think that will help you a lot as you all have to come together and make a plan. There's no I in team. There's nobody per se that does it better. Everybody has their individual things. So I'll give you an example about my own family. In my family, I'm more of the fix-it person, obviously. That's probably not a surprise to anybody, right? But I'm more the fix-it person. I'm the resource information person. I'm always researching. I'm always looking for new improved ways to communicate on a better level and trying to help my family with their issues, or issues of my mom, per se, or my sister, or my brother, or whatever it is. I am the peacekeeper, generally. So when my family would have discussions about my mom, I always made an agenda. Now, my family, for the most part, all lives in a small town. Only me and my brother live in a big city, Denver. And I'm used to agendas. I like agendas. I like following what we need to talk about. It keeps people from getting emotional. It shuts them down if they're focusing too much on the emotion of the situation. But it keeps everything on target. It keeps everything simple, okay? Now, I have another sister who I lovingly say she keeps the emotion at the forefront. She always wants to consider the feelings of everyone. She's always been a very touchy-feely person. So to her, it's important to understand the dynamics from an emotional standpoint. I obviously come at it from a very different place. I look at dollars. I look at processes. I am more of a project manager mindset. So that's a kind of a good balance to kind of keep me engaged that sometimes, and even today, even when I'm talking to people such as all of you out there in podcast land, that I get so directed on processes and strategies and techniques and things like that, that I forget sometimes the emotional piece behind everything that's going on. So in my family, I have a big family, so I'll keep going with my example here. I have another sister who tries to hear everybody's point of view. She is very, very good at listening to each person's information. And even if she thinks somebody is way off course and talking BS, she tries very hard to just keep the peace and not take sides and things like that. And I appreciate somebody that can be more of the mediator like that, that can keep people feeling like their feelings are at the forefront constantly. She is the sister that I can rely on if I need something done from afar. I can call her and talk to her about a situation, and she will talk it through with me, and she will also bring in the viewpoints of the other family members, which I just think is fantastic. Everybody's got their role. I have another sister who she is very straightforward. She is very opinionated. She goes straight with her thought. She no holds barred. And if somebody says something stupid or thoughtless or something like that, she'll call them out and say that was rude. We have our people that have the roles. And of those three, everybody has what they need to bring to the table. The one that I told you calls people out on stuff and everything, she turned out to be an absolutely wonderful caregiver for my mom, being able to help her with her daily needs, especially in the early stages, and really just wouldn't take any BS from anybody about anything, and just functioned from a very mama bear kind of standpoint. Right? My other sister that keeps the peace with everybody and sees everybody's point of view was terrific at taking my mom to the bank and to the grocery store and doing the things that she needed to do and talking to all the family members to keep us on top of our games and our plans and all that kind of stuff. And my sister, who deals from the emotional place, would always go with my mom to her doctor visits and talk to the doctor and so on and so forth. And so everybody had their thing that they did. And my brother from Denver here, he would send money for whatever my mom needed. We all banded together and tried to bring it to a place where everybody had their role and their function, and we could recognize that and work together peacefully. It's not always easy. My oldest brother was kind of having his own problems, but the things that he would do would be he'd come over and mow my mom's lawn and fix everything that she needed fixed in the house and making sure that her car was running. And so he was more of a fix-it guy from a hands-on tools and materials kind of standpoint. And then, of course, my little brother Norman, who's adopted, he came in. He did things I never thought he'd do, like taking my mom to dinner and polishing her fingernails and her toenails for her and playing cards with her and stuff like that. So we all had our role. We all had the things that we needed to do. Was it easy? Was it easy coming together? Did we always agree? No. No, we did not. And even when the time came when we needed to bring in a caregiver for my mom, I told you my role is kind of more project manager. My husband and I paid for a caregiver to come in and take care of her for a number of years. So we all have things that we need to do and accomplish. And if you can come together and just figure out what each person's role is, you're going to be so much better off. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute to talk about the end stage.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, so I've been talking about family roles when someone is ill with Alzheimer's or whatever dementia that it is. And there's a lot of facets to all of this. But at some point, as that person becomes more progressed and more ill with this disease, because it is terminal, it is progressive, it won't stop until they're gone, till they've met their demise, right? You're going to have to figure out a way to do the best you can with the other people that are involved, whether you like them or not. Because what the real reality is that at some point it's going to end. And I get asked this question all the time. People want to know, when is the person going to die? I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you that. I can tell you it's not when you think they're going to. You can take the thought of when you think they're getting into late stage and add another 3-4 years on it, and you're probably somewhere in the ballpark. I can certainly tell you that. You know, the thing is, even when people ask me, I understand why they're asking me, but usually my answer is not satisfactory to their liking because we don't know. We don't know. There's so many factors that have to converge that can cause someone to leave, to either be here or depart the world. And what are those factors? I mean, they could get sick with the flu, the COVID, whatever, and they make it through. Who'd have thought, right? And you don't even do anything for them. You just keep them comfortable and they survive it anyway. And you're thinking, oh man, I thought this was where this is it. And people ask, you know, I had this question the other day. Why doesn't she just quit and get it over with? It's not that families don't care. It's not that they want the person to die. But by the time they've reached the end stage and they're not speaking, they're not communicating, they've gone totally silent. They could be in a wheelchair. They could be walking around with an extremely shuffled gait. You know, every time we turn around and we think we've hit the place where it's all coming to an end, they regroup, they get a new breath, they come back to life, and it just makes us absolutely crazy, you know? And people ask all the time, is she going to get better? Why is it that all of a sudden, yesterday she looked like she was dying or he was dying, and today they look much better? They're rallying. They're starting to feel better. You know, in the late stage, when there's an enormous loss in the abilities and ways of functioning, I've literally had people say, should we give the person CPR and any medical treatment that they need, right? And I sit there and I shake my head, you know, because that person with memory loss is completely dependent on others for their physical care. And yet family members are wanting to know, should we get them through the flu? Should we get them through the COVID? I had a guy ask me yesterday, And I hope he's not listening to this podcast. And it's not funny. It's not funny. I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny. But his wife had fallen and broken her hip. She hasn't spoken for 4 years. She is in late Alzheimer's in a memory community. And I'm telling you, putting her through surgery to fix a broken hip, my only question has one word. Why? Why? Are they going to get better? Are they going to rally from this? Are they going to be able to talk to you? Are they going to be able to have quality of life? People, I am not heartless, and I don't mean it to sound this way. But this is where you need those directives in place, the do not resuscitates, the comfort care for hospice, where you're just making the person comfortable. Because I'm telling you what all these families have in common is that they're unable to let go of their loved one. Even though it feels like that person with memory loss has been steadily preparing to make their transition to death for years. I literally have had residents stay alive to just hit important, you know, residents. What I mean by like clients and residents of communities that I've helped move in, they have literally, I think, stayed alive to reach thresholds like a certain birthday that is longer than their parents or something like that. Or they want to reach an anniversary. They want to see a grandchild get married or something like that. Can they possibly have that cognitive thought that they want to stay in the game when they haven't communicated anything to anybody for a long time? I think so. So we've got the two-sided coin there. Are they cognitive enough to want something like that, to stay in the ballgame for something like that, but yet they can't communicate with you? They don't really know what they're eating for dinner. They have no ability to have a conversation with you or anything like that. The mind works in the most mysterious freaking ways. I mean, it really, really, really does. And the bottom line, I think everybody has to decide for themselves. Everybody has to make this decision, especially if it's a spouse and you don't want to let them go. You want to keep them alive. But the bottom line is, what quality of life are they going to have? Are they going to be able to converse with you? Is it important for them to converse with you? Or do you just still want them there? Are you afraid to be without them? Is your world lonely when you go home, but it's lonelier if you don't have them to go visit? Well, that's real. I mean, that's real. It's an emotional response. It's valid. I can't make that decision for any of you. But you do have to look at do you want to have medication sustain their life for another extended period of time? And again, I have to say, why? And I don't mean that as a negative. I just mean it as a really thoughtful question. Why? Why do you need to prolong their life? Do you have an issue with not wanting to play God? If you have those provisions set up and they don't get treated for the flu or the COVID or whatever it is, and they stay alive, then that's not on you. It's not like you're doing anything to make it worse for them. But like for my client, my friend, whose wife broke her hip, is she going to be in a lot of pain with a broken hip? She might be. The truth of the matter is, pain medications slow your heart rate. We've talked about this before. When they start giving morphine in late stages, it's a game changer. Morphine slows your blood pressure. It slows your heart rate. Chances of them living further with the pain medication is limited. It's limited. Now you put a time clock on it. Now you've got the hourglass running. It's there. It's working. It's out of your control at this point. But I think dental appointments, dental procedures, major procedures of falls and breaks and things like that make you stop and think about what you would do for that person if they are incapacitated. It's not about love. It's not even about money. It's not about any of those things. It's about quality of life. If you go through all the trouble to fix that broken hip, are they going to be able to rehab? No. Absolutely not. You're not going to be able to have a PT come in and help them because they're not going to understand what happens to them or what is happening to them. They're not going to walk on a treadmill to strengthen their leg or anything. They're going to be a person that is as incapacitated as they are and have been over the last few years with a new fixed hip that won't work and they won't walk on it anyway. That's the truth. It's the truth. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound harsh, but it's hard when people call me for advice in these areas and they want to know what they should do, and especially if it's family members, siblings that are trying to come together and figure this out. So the best thing I can advise you on is get hospice involved, especially in late stage, because they can bring in social workers to counsel you through end of life. They can talk to you about dehydration and the negative effects that can happen when a person is passing slowly. They can talk about comfort care, and if they are in any pain, giving them pain medications to help them feel better or to be able to get through a day. But these are deep, deep decisions, painful decisions, and it's all going to boil down to letting go. It's all going to boil down to letting go. And it's not fun for anybody. It's not ever easy to say goodbye to somebody that you love. If it were my husband, we've been married, we've been together for 26 years, and I love him dearly. He is the love of my life. He's my best friend. I can't imagine life without him. But I hope that if it were me and I were to get Alzheimer's and I were to be in a stage of incapacitation and not being able to function on my own, not being able to laugh or smile at him or recognize him or carry on conversations, our world as I know it right now, I would hope that he would make that decision for me to let me go. And I hope that I would be able to do that for him too. I mean, people, I don't know what you do. I don't know if you pray about it. I don't know if you discuss it. I don't know if you get a social worker and have therapy over it or whatever. But the whole issue is about letting go. And it's going to be about emotions. So my one sister that I've always said is emotional, I guess she wins out on this one, because it's going to come down in the end to managing your emotions and making good decisions and doing the best you can for that person. And I guess a good way to be introspective and look at it and think about it would be put yourself in the shoes of the person that is in late stage diagnosis. If you could see your life right now and put yourself in the situation that they're in at that moment in time, what would you want? What would you want? So for all of you who have called me, and I have literally received so many calls and emails over the last 2 weeks about end of life, about people who have their loved ones at home or in a memory care unit who have seen this COVID ravage the communities, ravage our homes, our lives as we have known it. And I told you that recently I did an interview about why are people dying more rapidly at 26% more. I think that we have a nation of people who are starting to learn to let go and to really be very compassionate and empathetic and loving to say that my person no longer can function like they were and can no longer function in a normal realm, and I'm going to not prolong that any longer. I'm not going to make this last any longer than it needs to. You're not playing God, but you've made some decisions not to resuscitate or not to treat these situations, which we would call palliative care, of trying to make someone better from the flu or COVID or something like that. As the fall and winter continues and gets worse, we're going to see the numbers of flu cases and COVID rising, which we already are. And some of you are going to be facing these decisions. And I'm just going to ask you to really look at this and be loving and introspective and thoughtful and ask yourself, can I let go? Well, that's our show for today. I love you all out there. I'll be saying prayers for you. And I know these are difficult times and difficult talks. If I don't tell you the truth, I'm nothing. So I wanted to be able to share this information today and really talk about what I feel is going on, especially with my clients and our friends with diagnosis. I'm with you. I love you. And I'll see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.